I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is novelist, essayist, and journalist Amos Oz. And now, join Lara Edelbaum Sunshine on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Amos Oz.
Israeli novelist Amos Oz is the author of 14 novels and collections of short fiction and numerous works of nonfiction. He is also widely considered the godfather of Israeli peaceniks and one of the most steadfast opponents to the establishment of Israeli settlements on Palestinian land. His acclaimed memoir, A Tale of Love and Darkness, was an international bestseller and recipient of the prestigious Goethe Prize, as well as the National Jewish Book Award. It was also adapted recently into a film by Natalie Portman. His new novel, Judas, is set in Jerusalem. It's 1959. Two of its characters are men with political outlooks that seemingly cannot coexist. Both are Jews. One sees war as something necessary, an inevitable fact of Israel's being an independent Jewish state. The other opposes Israel's claim to statehood, believing that claim caused the first Arab-Israeli war. For expressing that position, he was branded a traitor. In this very fraught time, Amos Oz's wise voice is more important than ever. We are so pleased he's agreed to be with us tonight. Please join me in extending a warm welcome to the incomparable Amos Oz.
Thank you, dear Lara, for this heartwarming introduction. I would be comfortable to sit there backstage and listen to you introducing me for the rest of tonight and go home feeling very good about myself. Ladies and gentlemen, friends, dear Goldman family, good evening, shalom, erev tov. This is going to be an evening about Judas, about treason and loyalty and some other issues. Let me begin by a very brief teaser. It's the opening part. These are the opening paragraphs of the novel. Here is a story from the winter days of the end of 1959 and the beginning of 1960. It is a story of error and desire, of unrequited love, and of a religious question that remains unresolved. Some of the buildings still bore the marks of the war that had divided the city a decade earlier. In the background, you could hear the distant strains of an accordion or the plaintive sound of a harmonica from behind closed shutters. In many flats in Jerusalem, you might find Van Gogh's starry whirlpool skies or his shimmering cypresses on the living room wall, rush mates on the floors of the small rooms, and Dr. Zhivago or Yizhar's Days of Tziklag lying open face down on a foam sofa bed that was covered with a length of Middle Eastern cloth and piled with embroidered cushions. A paraffin heater burnt all evening long with a blue flame. In a corner of the room, a tasteful bunch of thorn twigs sprouted from a mortal shell casing. At the beginning of December, Shmuel Ash abandoned his studies at the university and decided to leave Jerusalem because his relations had broken down, because his research had stalled, and especially because his father's finances had collapsed and Shmuel had to look for work. Shmuel was a stocky, bearded young man of around 25, shy, emotional, socialist, asthmatic, liable to veer from wild enthusiasm to disappointment and back again. His shoulders were broad, his neck was short and thick, and his fingers, too, were thick and short, as if they each lacked a knuckle. From every pore of Shmuel Asher's face and neck curled wiry hairs like steel wool. This beard continued upward till it merged with the tousled hair of his head and downward to the curling thicket of his chest. From a distance, he always seemed, summer and winter alike, to be agitated and pouring with sweat. But close up, it was a pleasant surprise to discover that instead of a sour smell of sweat, his skin somehow exuded a delicate odor of talcum powder. My friends, Judas is a novel of ideas and a Bildungsroman, a novel of coming of age. There are not many, very many novels of ideas in contemporary American literature. Not even very many in European literature, and I don't quite understand why. Because I think, after all, ideas, no less than emotions and urges and nightmares and subterranean desires, they are part of every one of us as being, every one of us as persona. When I say a novel of ideas, I certainly do not mean a manifesto. Judas is not a manifesto. Not even a bunch of contrasting and competing manifestos, no. It is essentially a story about three human beings, three strangers, initially totally antagonized to one another, who in the course of one winter change each other to some extent, even develop, evolve into almost loving one another. Judas, in my humble judgment, is a piece of chamber music, a string trio, if you wish, or if you count the ghosts, which are part of the cast of characters, we have a string quintet or even a string sextet. Judas, as you all know, Judas Iscariot from the Gospels, he is the ultimate traitor in Western civilization. The meanest, the ugliest, the most loathsome and repulsive, greedy, corrupt, conscienceless, cunning pretender. In every Christian language, and I have checked many dictionaries of language I do not know, in every single Christian dictionary, including the Oxford Dictionary, the word Judas simply means traitor. You call a person Judas, you spit in his or her face. In the 31 languages in which this novel is translated or under translation, the title is simply Judas. This is provocative enough. In Hebrew, and in Hebrew alone, I couldn't call it Judas because the Hebrew name Judas, Yehuda, is a very common and accepted name. Yehuda is like Simon or Johnny or David. It's a very everyday name. So if I called the book Yehuda, Judas, nobody will see any point. So in Hebrew, it's called the Gospel According to Judas. In my view, Judas Iscariot in the Gospels is the Chernobyl of Christian anti-Semitism for the last 2,000 years. And in recent years, even Muslim anti-Semitism is adopting this stereotype as a good, vicious weapon of Jew-hating. In the eyes of the enemies of the Jews, in the eyes of Jew haters, every Jew is a Judas. You know, it's not surprising. Think of a little child, let's say in Germany, who hears the story for the first time from a parent or a grandparent, the terrible story about the treason, the kiss, the 30 pieces of silver, the God killing. How can such a little child draw the line between Jude, Jew, and Judas, Judas? Or in Spanish, Judas and Judíos. No wonder that there is an inseparable association between Jews and Judases. Chernobyl of Christian anti-Semitism. We are all traitors in the eyes of our enemies. We are all God killers. We are all greedy. We are all corrupt. Gershom Wald, the crippled old man in the novel, he tells a story from his youth. He traveled in a Polish train many decades earlier, and he shared the compartment with two Catholic nuns. One was elderly, respectable, bespectacled. The other one was young, delicate, angelic. And at some point, there was no conversation, he took out of his pocket a Hebrew newspaper and started reading it. The older nun asked with some bewilderment. She said, "Gentlemen, you are not reading a Jewish newspaper, are you?" And he said, "Yes, I am. I'm a Jew myself, and I'm about to go to Jerusalem and settle there." Silence. Several seconds later, the young beauty, the angelic one, she asks in a voice close to tears, "How could you do that to him? He was so sweet." And Gershom Wald says, "You know, young lady, on that morning of the crucifixion, I wasn't there. I had a dentist appointment." This story happened to me, not in Poland, in another European Catholic country. Railway compartment, two nuns, respectable, bespectacled, elderly one, angelic, attractive young one. It was a Hebrew book, not a Hebrew newspaper. The same question. "Sir, are you reading a Jewish book?" "Yes, I am. I'm an Israeli. I'm from Israel." "How could you do that to him? He was so sweet." And to this very day, I kick myself for not telling the both of them that I had a dentist appointment. Gershom Wald also says, consider, he says, not everyone can simply wake up one morning, brush his teeth, drink a cup of coffee, and kill God. To do that, you have to be much stronger than God, and you have to be infinitely vicious, corrupt, and ugly. Ladies and gentlemen, this story is not an innocent story. It's an ugly story. Any decent editor should have edited it out of the gospel once and for all. Because of the racist stereotype. Because the bad guy is so trivial and stereotypical and utterly despiseful and deserves hatred. It was not edited out. And this single story caused more bloodshed, more persecution, more suffering than any other ever told in human history. It's a nasty one. This story is responsible for persecution, bloodshed, inquisition, pogroms, possibly the Holocaust. It's the worst story, ugliest story ever told. As I said, Chernobyl of Western anti-Semitism. Think about the image of Judas in famous Renaissance paintings of the Last Supper. There is Jesus in the middle of the table, looking divinely beautiful, delicate, attractive, sweet. There are his disciples, tall, obviously blonde, good-looking, many of them blue eyes, strictly Aryan. But at the corner of the table, there is this ugly, dark little Semitic type with balding head, big ears, huge, crooked, pornographic nose, thick lips, rotten teeth, and an evil smile on his lips. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is us. Not in Nazi propaganda, not in Der Stürmer, not the children of Goebbels, no. This is direct heritage from Christian art for thousands and thousands of years. The ugly, repulsive Jew. This story intrigued me, fascinated me, and infuriated me ever since I was a 16-year-old obsessive book reader in Kibbutz Hulda. I was reading day and night, and at some point I realized that they don't teach the Gospels in any Jewish school in Israel, in San Francisco, nowhere. And I realized that unless I read the Gospels, I will never be able to understand the music of Bach. I will never be able to understand any Christian liturgical music. I will never understand Renaissance art or architecture. I will never understand the cathedrals. I'll never be able to understand a Dostoevsky novel. So I went to the library every evening and read the Gospels. I read the New Testament. My classmates, the boys, they were on the basketball yard, all chasing the girls. I was hopeless at both, so I found comfort in Jesus Christ. I read the Gospels night after night. I fell in love with Jesus, his sense of humor, his wonderful simpleness, a very subtle simpleness, his warmth, his openness, his poetry, his remarkable sense of humor. He could be immensely funny. And his ideas. I loved him, but I disagreed with him. You never get two Israelis to agree with one another on anything at all, ever. It's very rare to find one Israeli in agreement with himself or herself because every one of us has a divided mind and soul. So I disagreed with Jesus about the idea of universal love, which I thought was a childish and impossible and sentimentalist idea, revived by the generation of the 60s here in California, of all places. Everyone should love everybody else. Make love, not war. However, I rejected this simple notion. I disagreed with Jesus when he says, "Forgive them, for they know not what they are doing." It's not that I disagreed with the forgiveness. Yes, sometimes we have to forgive. Not always, but sometimes. No. I was angry with the, "for they know not what they are doing." What? Does he take all of us for moral infantiles, moral idiots? Of course, when we inflict pain on others, we know exactly what we are doing. We still do it sometimes, but we know what we are doing when we inflict pain on others. So I rejected this notion of they know not what they are doing. However, I disagreed with him, argued with him, and loved him. But when I got to the story of the most notorious kiss in history, more famous than Romeo and Juliet kissing, the most famous 30 pieces of silver, the treason, the betrayal, the God-killing, I exploded with anger, not for Jewish chauvinistic reasons, not for theological reasons, no. The little detective in me at the age of 16 rebelled against the impossibility, the illogicality of this silly story. First and foremost, I took the trouble to find out how much money were the most famous 30 pieces of silver in history. Google had not existed in those days, but there were books, and I quickly discovered that the 30 pieces of silver in the days of Jesus Christ were roughly the equivalent of 650 or 680 US dollars. It's a handsome sum of money. It's not a fortune. And unlike the other disciples of Jesus who were poor fishermen from Galilee, Judas is presented in the Christian scriptures as a wealthy man, landowner. He had slaves and servants and orchards and fields. Why should he sell his master, his spiritual father, his guide and shepherd, his God, for $670? And if he did, if he was so greedy and so corrupt that he couldn't overcome his greed and grab those $670, why would he hang himself immediately after?
You're listening to novelist, essayist, and journalist Amos Oz, whose latest novel is Judas, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Worse still, who on earth should bother to pay Judas even a dime for kissing Jesus, thus identifying him to the messengers of the priesthood who came to arrest Jesus? The whole of Jerusalem knew Jesus. He preached in street corners. A couple of days earlier, he perpetrated a terrible scandal when he angrily and violently turned over the tables of the money changers at the entrance to the temple because they were desecrating the holy place. He forgot that he was Jesus. He forgot that he was against violence. He grew very angry and he violently attacked those money changers. I like him for that. However, everybody knew him. And when they came to arrest him, as far as we know, he did not shave his beard. He was not wearing a sombrero. And he was not claiming to the jailers, no, I am not Jesus. I am Donald Trump. Why the 30 pieces of silver? Why a dime to identify a man who was known to everyone and who made not the slightest attempt to hide his identity or to run away? Didn't make any sense to me. And I knew that this was a nasty story, a bloody story. And as I said, no other story in history is responsible for so much hatred, persecution, and bloodshed. I hated it. In this novel, in Judas, you will find a totally different version of the story. The version is from my protagonist, from Shmuel Ash, but I rather like his version. He suggests that Judas, who was not a fisherman from Galilee, he was close to the circles of the priesthood in Jerusalem, a noble man. He was dispatched to Galilee by the priesthood to make some inquiries about that strange miracle worker, village healer. We hear all kinds of rumor. He got some fellowship in the faraway provinces. Please go find out, come back and write a report. So Judas wraps himself in rugs and barefoot he joins the bunch of disciples and followers. And then he undergoes a change of heart. He loves Jesus and he starts believing in Jesus, according to Shmuel Ash. He is convinced that Jesus is the Messiah. He is convinced that Jesus is here to save the world. He is convinced that Jesus is Son of God and he loves him. It was difficult not to love him. He was a very lovable man, according to the stories of the gospel. In fact, he loves Jesus, the Son of God, more than he loves God. Judas always had problems with the God of the Jews, an angry God, vindictive God, sometimes destructive and ferocious God, sometimes a jealous God, whereas Jesus was meek and mild. He loves Jesus. He knows Jesus is the Savior, but he is a man of the world. Judas. He knows that Jesus could go on working rural miracles in remote places. For the next 100 years, this will not save the world. He must go to Jerusalem. And he must perform the miracle of all miracles in Jerusalem. He must get crucified in front of the whole city and the whole world. And he will get off the cross, healthy and intact and alive. And the whole world will be watching. And the whole world will be kneeling before him. And he will say to everyone, love one another. And this, believed Judas, will be the beginning of the kingdom of heaven. This will be the salvation of the humankind. This will be the conversion into the religion of love. This will be the miracle of all miracles, after which no more miracles will ever be needed. He wants Jesus to go to Jerusalem. He wants Jesus to get crucified and walk off the cross, prime time on television, Friday, the eve of Passover, when Jerusalem is flooded with hundreds of thousands of pilgrim makers from the four corners of the country and from the exiles. And Romans and Hellenists and Greeks and Edomites and Arabs, everybody will be there. Everybody watch. Jesus is not happy to go to Jerusalem. The Gospels, not Shmuel Ash, the Gospels tell us that Jesus is filled with fear of death. Very human fear of death, like you and me. He doesn't want to go to Jerusalem, knowing, feeling that if he goes to Jerusalem, they will kill him. And he's afraid of death. This repeats itself in the Gospels 5 or 6 times, that Jesus doesn't want to go to Jerusalem. Maybe next year, not now. Judas is working on him. Judas says, you must do this and you can do this. You have done more than that. You have shown us that you can walk on the water. You can turn stones into bread and water into wine. You can heal the sick. You have revived the dead. Go on the cross. Your Father in heaven will get you off the cross. And this will be it. The kingdom of heaven will begin. Jesus is half-hearted. You know, in Shmuel Ash's version, Judas believed in Jesus a lot more than Jesus ever believed in himself. Jesus is filled with doubts. Is it me? Am I the man? Please, God, please, Father in heaven, give me just one more sign and another one and another one. Is it really me? Judas has no such signs. And he persuades Jesus to go to Jerusalem on the eve of the Passover. And in Jerusalem, it's not simple to arrange a crucifixion for Jesus. Nobody is particularly interested to crucify him. He's not a big shot. He's a small fish. He's backwater. The city is full of prophesizing people and religious freaks and redeemers, then and now. And the same about Galilee, then and now. So yet another one. The priesthood is not impressed by Jesus. They won't bother to kill him. And the Romans are even less impressed. Well, yet another mad Jew drunk on God. What else is new? Judas has to use his connections. He has to make plenty of telephone calls to arrange this crucifixion. And in the end, they do it out of certain indifference. One more, one less, who cares? Judas wants it so badly, let's do it for him. Not a solo crucifixion, this is asking too much, but a crucifixion in the middle between two small-time criminals. And Jesus bleeds on the cross hour after hour after hour, screaming with pain, screaming not to his God, but to his mother, who is there at the foot of the cross. And the time flies, and it's hot and dusky and filthy, as Jerusalem can be in April. And it's the eve of Passover, and the crowd is beginning to disperse. Nothing new. This is repeating itself. Nothing is happening. And Judas says to Jesus from the foot of the cross, well, do it, Master. Do it, Rabbi. Do it now. This is the time. Show them. And Jesus, poor Jesus, he tries. He tries to pull his hands and his feet off the cross. He tried to pull out the nails. And when this is not working, he dies pronouncing the most famous words ever pronounced by any human being in history. He says, oh God, oh my God, why have you forsaken me? These are the words of the Psalms, by the way. Now, these words could only come, says Shmuel Ash, these words could only come from a man who up to the last moment believed, or at least half believed, that yes, he would walk off the cross. His Father in heaven will take him off the cross. Oh God, why have you forsaken me? And with these words on his lips, he dies on the cross. And with him dies Judas, really. Because Judas suddenly realized, what has he done? What has he done with his fanatic urge to bring about an immediate redemption? Now. So yes, he goes and hangs himself. And Shmuel Ash concludes, when Judas hangs himself, thus died the first Christian, the last Christian, the only Christian. Very, very provocative words. Many of my readers in Poland, in France, in Italy, in Spain, in Latin America, this book is in 16 languages already and 14, 15 more in the pipeline. Many of my readers disliked it immensely. They were offended. But I am telling you, Shmuel Ash's version is more persuasive, at least to this reader, than the impossible, stupid, ugly version of the Gospels. Shmuel's Judas believed in Jesus more than Jesus ever believed in himself. Is this how things really happened? I don't know. You know, I had a dentist appointment. But this version is more acceptable, more logical than the other one. So, Judas, as the Christians say, as our enemies say, Judas killed Jesus, but not because he was a traitor, because he was a fanatic. Because he was a blind believer. Because he was impatient. Because he wanted instant redemption. Here and now, instantly. Because he wouldn't wait. And Shmuel goes on pondering about traitors throughout history. And he writes, Shmuel, in this book, he says, sometimes, not always, sometimes, a traitor is simply a person who is ahead of his time or ahead of her time. Many, many times, a person who changes is labeled a traitor by his contemporaries, by his compatriots, who despise change, who hate change, who cannot even imagine change, and who fear change. And they call he or she who do change a traitor. Yes, yes, I'm involved in this club. Let me tell you, it's a very distinguished club. Let's have a very quick bird's eye view on the history of traitors. Begin with the prophet Jeremiah in the Old Testament, our Jeremiah, who told the kings and the people in Jerusalem, please stop behaving as if you were a superpower. You are not. Stop being arrogant. Stop being uncompromising. Consider the others, consider the neighbors, consider the existing of huge forces whom you are antagonizing again and again. Seek a compromise. Be realistic. This could be in an Israeli newspaper today, not in every Israeli newspaper, unfortunately, but it could still be in an Israeli newspaper today. Jeremiah's listeners did not like it at all. The kings did not like it, and the crowds did not like it. They put him in jail. They called him a traitor. You should have seen the talkbacks diverted at him in those days on the internet. Now I skip some thousands of years and I think about one of the greatest American heroes ever. I think about Abraham Lincoln, who set the slaves free. Millions of Americans called him a traitor. They launched a bloody civil war against him and ultimately they killed him. He was ahead of his time, this traitor. So was Winston Churchill, who dismembered the British Empire and was labeled a traitor by millions of Britons for doing this in the late 40s, early 50s. So was Charles de Gaulle, who was elected president by the vote of the far right in France and with the silent support of the military in order to retain and protect the Frenchness of the French colonies in North Africa. And instead of doing what he was expected to do, he ended up granting freedom to the Algerians. He was called a traitor. They tried to kill him. Think of Anwar Sadat, who traveled all the way, interplanetary, intergalactical distance from Cairo to Jerusalem, to stretch his hand to the Israelis and offer them peace. He was labeled a traitor by millions of Arabs. He still is regarded as a traitor by millions of Arabs. And he paid with his life. Quite recently, think of Mikhail Gorbachev, this complete product of Bolshevik upbringing and communist brainwash and Komsomol. And he rose one day and then undone, dismantled the entire communist bloc. Many true red communists regard him as a traitor. Think of the writers, the intellectuals, the creators. Think of the courageous and gifted artists here in this country, here in this part of the country, who were labeled traitors in the days of Senator McCarthy. Think of Thomas Mann, who left Germany as soon as Hitler came to power, never to come back. Think of Solzhenitsyn. Think of Emil Zola. And in our own Jewish, Israeli, Zionist history, the father of Zionism himself, the prophet of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, he was labeled traitor by many early Zionists because for a while he considered Uganda as a temporary, he called it night shelter homeland for the Jewish, persecuted Jewish people in Europe because Palestine seemed unobtainable for the time being. They called him a traitor. The founding father of the State of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, the man who had the guts to accept the fact that the land of Israel / Palestine is the legitimate homeland of two different nations, and there is no way but to partition it and create two national homelands, Israel and Palestine. He accepted the UN partition plan. Many Israelis call him a traitor for that, not only on the right wing, even some on the very idealistic left wing called him a traitor for accepting the idea of partitioning the land into two states. Menachem Begin, the leader of the Israeli far right, who decided to give back the whole of Sinai to Egypt in return for a peace document, he was labeled a traitor. Yitzhak Rabin and my beloved friend Shimon Peres, when they have decided in the early 1990s to recognize the Palestinian national movement, to seek a compromise, territorial compromise with this movement, they were labeled traitors, and Rabin paid with his life, as did Sadat. Even Ariel Sharon, who ultimately dispatched his own bulldozers to raise his own beloved settlements from the Gaza Strip. Even he was called a traitor. And I could go on and on for the rest of the night. You know, it's a very distinguished club. Ask myself, which club is more adorable? The club of the leaders and intellectuals and writers who were labeled traitors by some of their contemporaries and compatriots. And the club of those who were never stained as traitor, I think the first club is much more distinguished. When they call me a traitor, I pick this and put it on my lapel next to the Legion d'honneur given to me by President Jacques Chirac 10 years ago. I'm very proud of the fact that some of my contemporaries call me a traitor. Here will come the only directly political sentence in this presentation tonight. And those of you who don't like it are perfectly all right to put it in brackets and ignore it. Ladies and gentlemen, the day some Israelis will start calling Netanyahu a traitor, I will know that something is moving at last. Close brackets, all right.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features novelist, essayist, and journalist Amos Oz, whose latest novel is Judas. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Treason and loyalty are very central in this novel, but they are not the heart of the novel. Jerusalem is in the heart of the novel. Not today's Jerusalem, not greater Jerusalem. The Jerusalem of the late 1950s, a divided city, an injured city, divided by barbed wires and concrete walls and minefields and no man's land, injured, sad, beautiful, creative, vibrating with originality. I miss that Jerusalem sometimes. It was no paradise, but I miss it. And this Jerusalem is a character in the novel. And in a way, she is very close to Atalia. Here I am digressing and telling you something ahead of time in this presentation. Atalia, the female protagonist of this novel, she is Jerusalem. Proud, deeply injured, very angry, creative, original, beautiful, independent, attractive, a feminist long before feminism. Okay, three people sit in a secluded house for 3 months. Storm and rain and wind and cold hitting the windows from the outside. And those three, they sit for the whole winter. They talk and talk and talk and they drink gallons of tea. They are not just three people. They are three totally different planets. They differ in age. The old cripple, the old handicapped man, Gershom Wald, is 70. The young idealist, Shmuel Ash, is 25. A dropout from university. Atalia is middle-aged, attractive, sexy, not sexy, erotic in a deep way, and unobtainable. Each one of them comes from a totally different emotional, intellectual, and sexual planet. They are strangers as could be. And lo and behold, in the course of one winter, they become closer and closer to each other. In the course of one winter, they almost become a family, almost. In the course of one winter, 3 months, they almost, I'm careful, I say almost, they almost get to love one another. This is the secular miracle of the novel Judas. This is the optimistic message. Yes, they change each other. People do change, I'm telling you. That's how I make a living, by watching people change. If you wish, this is my tiny little optimistic message for America of November 2016. Yes, people do change. They are not born again. They don't change completely, but they do change. And they change each other. And yes, people even surprise themselves and others sometimes. I don't know you in the auditorium. I can't even see you because the lights are in my eyes. But I am sure every single one of you have surprised herself or himself a few times in the course of your lives. Every one of you asked herself or himself once or twice at least, is this really me? Am I doing what I am doing? Unbelievable. People are open-ended. This table will never change. This glass will never change. It will decompose. I hope it will be recycled. But it wouldn't change. People do change. They change one another and they change themselves. This is my business. This is how I make a living, by watching people change. This novel is about how three people change one another. And yes, they are different. The old man, Gershom Wald, is a skeptic, bitter skeptic. He lost his beloved only son, Micha, in Israel's War of Independence. Micha died a dreadful death, too dreadful to detail here, on the battle for the road to besiege Jerusalem. He died on the night of April 2nd, 1948. So Micha died, and Gershom believes in nothing except in Ben-Gurion. He does believe in Ben-Gurion. But for him, all religions, all faiths, all ideologies, all political and social visions are potentially deadly. They all begin with a wonderful singing of wonderful fresh bells calling for a new dawn for the world. Judaism, Christianity, Islam, socialism, radicalism, anarchism, they all start wonderfully. But all of them, without exception, ending up shedding a lot of innocent blood, persecuting and oppressing their rivals. They all lead to jihads and crusades and inquisitions and gulags and torture chambers and concentration camps and gas chambers. The world, says Gershom Wald, is horrible, but leave it alone. Don't try to fix it. You try to fix it, you shed blood, innocent blood. Leave it as is. Not because it's wonderful, far from being wonderful, far from being perfect, but please, please don't even try to fix it. The young man, Shmuel Ash, who is hired as a caregiver for the old man, not physical caregiver. The old man can manage on crutches. He looks after himself most of the time. No, he is a spiritual caregiver. He is supposed to ferociously argue with the old man a few hours every day in order to keep the old man alert. And Shmuel Ash is an idealist, a world reformer, a former communist. Now, in the time of the story, he is a mixture of an admirer of Che Guevara and Fidel Castro. He hangs their posters in his new room, but also a disciple of the new winds of love and brotherhood and pacifism blowing all the way from California to Jerusalem. Make love, not war. All you need is love. We are all brothers, we are all sisters. He's there, he's one of those. You can imagine that Wald and him are like fire and ice. They fight like hell. And in the middle, there is Atalia. And Atalia is angry with the entire male sex, period. She uses men, she takes them to bed, one after the other. And they get thrown out of her bed after a few days, after a week or two, sometimes after one night. But for her, man has been running the world for thousands of years, and they turned the world into a slaughterhouse. To her, men are eternal teenagers who will never mature. To her, men are infantile. They depend on an everlasting stream of ego, shots of ego reinforcing, or else they shrivel and become monsters. They need to be irrigated twice a day, or else they become monsters. She says, Atalia, that a moral sense in a man is only possible in the very short intervals while his sexual urges are temporarily sated. That's when men may have a moral sense. Well, she's ahead of her time, in a way. Imagine those three. Imagine how remote they are from each other. But apart from those three, there are also ghosts in the house. I don't mean ghosts wrapped in white sheets and making funny noises at night. No, but they are very present, and they are part of the debate, part of the conversation, part of the argument, part of the disagreement. There is the ghost of Jesus Christ, universal love. There is the ghost of Judas, the ultimate traitor. There is the ghost of Micha Wald, Gershom Wald's son and Atalia's beloved husband. Gershom Wald's only son and the man, the only man Atalia ever loved. And there is the ghost of Shealtiel Abravanel, Atalia's father, a prominent Zionist leader, ninth generation Jerusalemite, a man who is equally at home in Arabic, in Hebrew, in Greek, in Turkish, and in French, and in English. A Jerusalemite, a Zionist leader, prominent one, a member of the Zionist executive, a member of the board of the Jewish agency, which is the shadow government of the Jews in British Palestine. Don't Google him, he's not there. Not even the likes of him. Abravanel shocks everyone by pronouncing just before the creation of Israel his objection to the very idea of a Jewish state, his disagreement with Ben-Gurion, his objection of the very goal of political Zionism, Jewish sovereignty. He is immediately ostracized, kicked out, labeled a traitor by everyone in the country, everyone, left and right. He lives for the rest of his life under a self-imposed home arrest in the same little stone house in the end of the Jerusalem, the house with the gallons of tea. And his ghost is there, arguing, debating, challenging. There is even the ghost of David Ben-Gurion in the house, and I know it's funny because at the time David Ben-Gurion is still the omnipotent king of Israel. He is prime minister and defense minister, but his ghost is in the house, taking part in the seminary, in the debate. Now, two very famous traitors, Judas and Abravanel, in one volume. Many of my readers and critics were quick to equate those two traitors, to think that they are mirror images, one from ancient times, one from contemporary times. Oh no, they are not. They are not at all. Judas, the old traitor, is very close to Shmuel Ash, to young Shmuel Ash, to Shmuel Ash at the beginning of the novel. They both believe in instant redemption. They both believe in a one-line key for redemption, for universal salvation. They both believe in a big revolution. They don't both believe in one liberating act which will redeem the world. Judas and Shmuel Ash. Abravanel, no, he's closer to Jesus. He believes in love and brotherhood. He believes, like Jesus, that nation states are obsolete, outdated, anachronistic. Why, he says to his colleagues in the Zionist leadership, why go into a armed conflict with the Arabs, with the Palestinians, with the neighboring Arab countries, with the whole of Islam, just to create a tiny little Jewish state at an age when nation states are about to vanish completely? It's the end of this age. The whole idea is anachronistic. To Abravanel, he is not a binationalist. It's not that he proposes a Jewish Palestinian binational state as an alternative to partition, as an alternative to the political Zionism. No, he is against any state. To him, to Abravanel, a world divided into hundreds of nation states with passports and barbed wires and armies and missiles and artillery, this is a murderous anachronism. This, he says, is like putting people in separate cages. The shrewd Gershom Wald responds by saying, yes, maybe, but when people behave like savage animals, maybe it's not such a bad idea to put them in separate cages. However, Abravanel, like Jesus, believed that everyone should love everyone else. We are all brothers and sisters. Yes, it should be a pluralistic world, many civilizations, many traditions, many religions, many languages, many faiths and believers, but not one nation state. Love should prevail. Abravanel believes in this. That's why he was ostracized. That's why he was called a traitor. Gershom Wald, and behind him the ghost of Ben-Gurion. They have an answer. They say, you know, the idea of world without countries, without boundaries, without weapons is a wonderful idea. Peoples without territorial homelands, wonderful idea. But why should we, the Jews, always be the first ones? We Jews have given the world for 2,000 years a one-man show, or maybe a one-people show, of how a people, a civilization can exist with no country, no defense, no army, no territory, no weapons. The world audience very rarely clapped. More often bombarded the actor with rotten eggs, and even more often simply slaughtered the actor. So now, for a change, as long as everyone else have bars on their windows and lock on their doors and electronic alarm systems, we Jews will have the same and perhaps will have it on the double. When the day comes and everybody else knocks their walls and open up and the whole humankind becomes one happy family, we will be delighted to join the orgy. We will be sure to be there very gladly, but we won't be the first one in the world, not even the first ones in the neighborhood. For our long historical memory made us cautious, and we will be the fifth in the neighborhood, the tenth in the world. Powerful response to a powerful argument. This is part of what I mean by novel of ideas, this debate between Abravanel and Ben-Gurion and Wald on nation states. But this debate cuts deeper. I wish to conclude by reading to you six lines from a nameless poem by the Israeli poet Leah Goldberg, who was born 1910 and died in Jerusalem 1970. If you welcome me into the dead of your darkness, perhaps then my day will be brighter. If you set on my shoulders the bulk of your burden, perhaps then my load will be lighter. Add the chill of your gloom to the frost of my sorrow. Perhaps then my bones will be warmer. And this, ladies and gentlemen, this is the minor miracle, the secular miracle in the novel Judas. I thank you for your patience and for your tolerance. Thank you very much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was novelist, essayist, and journalist Amos Oz, whose latest novel is Judas. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espelay, Maya Finley, and Jake Kukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.